Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So, Trump associate and longtime political gadfly, Roger Stone, sentenced to 40 months in federal prison, a couple years probation, $20,000 fine. 40 months in federal prison yesterday. And the question is, should Trump pardon Roger Stone? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. He's resisted resisted any decision on that to this point, suggested he's holding off. And one of the reasons he could hold off is that that sentence may not be served immediately because the federal judge in the case is considering a motion for a retrial based on a tainted jury. And so
there's one
Trump
juror,
may be waiting for that.
One juror who is clearly hates President Trump. And so, yes, they think with that one juror that was a tainted jury pool.
There's more than one. That you're talking about Memphis City Schools Board President Tamika Hart.
Right.
She was the foreperson of the jury. History of Democrat activism, string of anti-Trump social media posts, including retweeting arguments mocking those who considered Stone's dramatic arrest to be excessive. Also, it emerged that Judge Amy Berman Jackson had denied a defense request to strike a potential juror who is an Obama-era press official with admittedly anti-Trump views and whose husband worked at the division of the Justice Department that handled the probe leading to Stone's arrest. That's a conflict. Additionally, another juror donated to former Democrat presidential candidates and other progressive causes, according to federal election workers records. So there's ample case to be made potentially for a tainted jury pool, a tainted jury. That was extracted from the jury pool. And so we'll see what Judge Jackson decides, and that may be what Trump is waiting for.
And while you were gone, when Sean from Elmwood Park filled in, he kept saying, "This scumbag." Thank you. I love my Sean impersonation.
Yeah, it's very good.
"This scumbag tainted with witnesses." Well, not really. And President Trump addressed that yesterday, too. He wasn't really tampering. He was, the man who he allegedly tamper or the witness tampering. His name is Randy Credico.
Randy Credico.
Credico. Hey, Randy Credico.
Witness intimidation, which Randy Credico rejected.
Yeah, and he's a radio host and a comedian, and he said that they were just joking around. It was not. And he even penned a letter to the judge saying, please don't charge him with witness tampering or sentence him for witness tampering.
Yeah, I mean, just to get to the case.
Right, sounds a little off.
But to get to the case, and then we can get to the decision Trump has to make. Tucker Carlson actually had a nice summation of the case, and you can readily hear where Tucker Carlson is coming from on the matter on Wednesday night. So this was before the sentencing.
Roger Stone is scheduled to be sentenced tomorrow in federal court. He faces, as you know, 9 years in prison, effectively the rest of his life, for lying to Congress during the course of the Mueller investigation. Like the Russia collusion fantasy itself, Stone's prosecution was wholly political. It was a shocking insult to the American tradition of equal justice. Obama appointed Judge Amy Berman Jackson, an open Democratic partisan, allowed a former congressional candidate, a Democrat, with a history of attacking Stone to run the jury in the case. Then Judge Jackson stripped Stone of his First Amendment rights. She threatened to send him to jail if he tried to defend himself in public. That's why Roger Stone isn't on this show tonight. He'd go to prison for it. The whole thing is enough to shake your faith in our justice system, unfortunately. President Trump could end this travesty in an instant with a pardon, and there are indications tonight that he will do that. In the last 24 hours, he's done the same for former police commissioner Bernie Kerik and for financier Michael Milken. Democrats will become unhinged if Trump pardons Roger Stone, but they're unhinged anyway. What has happened to Roger Stone should never happen to anyone in this country, of any political party, to Democrats as well, ever. It's completely immoral. It's wrong. Fixing it is the right thing to do. And in the end, that is the only thing that matters.
And President Trump spoke yesterday openly, was following it all day long on social media.
And Roger's definitely a character. I'm following this very closely, and I want to see it play out. How can you have a jury pool tainted so badly? It's not fair. It's not fair. And, you know, it's not happening to a lot of other people. They say he lied. But other people lied, too. Just to mention, Comey lied. McCabe lied. You don't know who these people are? Just trust me. They all lied.
Yeah, so the issue is a couple of fold. One, what Tucker Carlson said, in terms of the political calculus, Democrats would become unhinged. They're unhinged anyway.
Yeah,
that's built
matter.
Into the price, number one. Number two, the sort of whataboutism, the everybody's doing it and some people are being prosecuted and other people are not. That doesn't exonerate Roger Stone. So the question is, do you use your pardon power to, I guess in a way, send a message to those who clearly by their behavior believe that there are two separate systems of justice, one for them and one for everybody else? You use your pardon power as a message sender, as a way to, you know, right the balance, if you will, right the scales of justice. Because, yeah, Roger Stone is a buffoon as far as I'm concerned. I have I would not rally to the defense of Roger Stone as a human being or a political operative for that matter. But isn't that exactly the sort of person our justice system was designed to protect? The justice system, the adversarial process, due process, that's not to protect the popular person, because, of course, everybody would want the popular person to be treated fairly. It's to protect the unpopular person whose life is on the line. Just like we talk about free speech. Free speech isn't there to protect the First Amendment's protection of freedom of speech. It's not there to protect popular speech. Popular speech doesn't need protection. It's unpopular speech that needs protection. And I think there is a pretty strong case to be made here. Mark Penn, a Clintonista, you know, former Hillary Clinton pollster, had a good op-ed in The Hill about this. And he has written about this previously, as he notes, pointing out how unfair the entire prosecution was. And including the arrest. And so Tucker pointed out that the judge in the case put a gag order on Stone.
Yeah.
Because she didn't want him to taint the jury pool.
Well, but he did put out a picture of her and then with a little, you know, Target sign behind or near her head.
So? She put a gag order on him.
That takes some cojones. I would never do that. Well, but he's Roger Stone.
The question is a gag order.
Yeah.
She put a gag order on him to so he wouldn't taint the jury pool. That's the argument. But they had no problem having the federal government embed CNN in their, Tom Clancy-esque raid on Roger Stone's house.
They knew all about it. They had a chopper up and ready to go.
But what does that say? It's okay for CNN, in conjunction with law enforcement, to do this over-the-top raid in order to send the message to the public, the jury pool, that this is a serious criminal, a real threat to public order. Yeah. So it's okay on that side of it, but it's not okay on the Roger Stone side of it to defend himself in public and say whatever he's got to say. So the unfairness of this from the beginning, Mark Penn's one line on this that I like: I'm no fan of Stone's tactics and history. I am a fan of an FBI and DOJ that treat everyone equally. Yeah, that's where I am.
Yeah, and clearly that didn't happen.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy talking about Roger Stone's 41 sentence and whether Trump should pardon him. Lewis on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Hello.
Okay, I'm going to make a comment and then I'm going to make a statement. Okay. This is my comment. What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that somewhere.
Failure to launch.
Yeah. It was, what was it? I think it was Cool Hand Luke with Paul Newman.
That's right.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
All right, now back to Lewis on the South Side.
Well, noted, I went away. Now I'm
noted captain impersonator. All right, go ahead, Lewis.
Okay. Now, what applies here is what they call fruits of the poison tree.
Yeah.
Okay, Stone was convicted of not cooperating with the investigators in a Russian collusion investigation that started with a faulty FISA warrant. Okay, and so I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't go along with the president if he decided to pardon Stone, Flynn, and those other two guys who were subject to that investigation, which they found out that the investigation was faulty.
Lewis, it's not a bad argument you make. Thanks for the call. Lewis, doubling as captain from Cool Hand Luke and jailhouse lawyer, the fruit of the poisonous tree argument, right? An illicit FISA warrant that was the predicate for the investigation that produced the process crime against Roger Stone. You know, but for them obtaining the surveillance warrants, would Roger Stone have been in a position to commit those crimes? It's an interesting argument. John and Phillip Park.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, again, almost every article I've read on Stone, in the end, always says he went down protecting Trump. And we know that's a false narrative. So the media is really kind of, you know, culpable of that as well, aren't they?
That's a good point, too. Right. Protecting Trump.
From what?
There's the Russian collusion.
There was no Russian collusion.
Yeah. And Roger Stone, the secret agent man who was the go-between for Assange and WikiLeaks. Yeah, that turned out to be Roger Stone fantasy, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, being a fantastical showman and, you know, and somebody that has an on-again, off-again relationship with the truth. That in this context, is that legitimately punishable by 40 months in federal prison?
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Please go away. Let me sleep for the love of God.
On AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy and Mike Bloomberg. Salt Lake City, day after...
Is he salty?
His debate performance.
Oh, see what I did there?
I did, yeah.
It did make you laugh.
Well, keep at it.
Okay.
I'm a tough audience.
And I've got a few hours still.
Here's what he had to say about the debate, trying to move past it.
So how was your night last night? Look, the real winner in the debate last night was Donald Trump.
Media consultant.
Because I worry that we may very well be on the way to nominating somebody who cannot win in November. And if we choose a candidate who appeals to a small base like Senator Sanders, it will be a fatal error.
It's an interesting argument he makes. I mean, that's the obvious argument, which I guess is why it's not that interesting. But it just turns out not to be true. So one of the things that has been very significantly underreported is what Bernie's standing is among regular Democrat primary voters, even those that are not necessarily voting for him right now. High floor, low ceiling. That's the argument against Sanders, right? That's why he can't get home. Maybe not. Maybe not nearly as much as the elites in the Democrat Party would want you to think. They have a disproportionate voice. That's the narrative that's been pushed. It's a narrative that we should believe. Or is it closer to a recognition that is occurring, including among former Obama flack David Plouffe, that Bernie is all but inevitable, that it's going to be very difficult for the Democrats to nominate somebody other than him if he comes to the convention with a plurality of the delegates, which is what is likely to occur.
And he said when that happens, he's going to claim victory.
Of course he would. Everybody would.
Yeah. Whoever has the most delegates at the convention time.
Monmouth University survey. Peter Beinart writes about this in The Atlantic. Bernie Sanders' favorable rating among Democrats nationally, 71%. Unfave, 19%. 71 to 19, almost a 5-to-1 or almost a 4-to-1 spread. That's big. That's solid. It's also higher than his top five rivals. His unfavorability rating, 19%, tied for second lowest. Sanders' net favorability rating is 6 points higher than Warren's, 16 points higher than Biden's, 18 points higher than Mayor Pete's, 23 points higher than Klobuchar's, and 40 points higher than Bloomberg's. And admittedly, there's a name ID gap, too, so that helps explain part of it, particularly Klobuchar and Buttigieg, Klobuchar, and Bloomberg. But 71 to 19. So as the field continues to winnow, and assuming that Bernie Sanders continues to rack up victories and delegates or strong place, second place finishes, which also confer delegates, the idea that this is a majority, that this is a party for whom the majority will ultimately reject Bernie when it comes down to a 1-to-1 or a 1-to-2 others type of race, those numbers say no. Those numbers say no. You know what?
We're going with him.
Bernie may not be my choice, but I'm satisfied with him. He makes that I've got the most delegates argument. I'm going to be sympathetic to that because I otherwise like him. Totally misrepresenting the strength of Bernie's position has been the Democrat establishment that you see on the talkies and on the op-ed pages for the last several weeks. And that poll really speaks to it.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And no less than our own Tiny Dancer.
Oh, boy.
A perfect example of what I'm talking about. He has an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. Bernie Sanders, the insider. Good luck. This is the master communicator. Oh, the DCCC who engineered take back over the House under W. Good luck. Good luck, Tiny Dancer. He's going to try to rebrand Bernie Sanders as the insider. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what he does here. That's what he does here. Senator Bernie Sanders is an anomaly. As someone who's running for the Democrat nomination without even being a Democrat, he presents himself as an outsider. But Sanders has been making the same argument about profit-seeking corporations and greedy executives for decades. It's pretty hard to maintain a legitimate claim on the change agent persona when your most memorable line in the campaign is, "I wrote the damn bill." Perhaps it's no surprise that his support in New Hampshire fell from 60% in 2016 to 26% this year. Radical as his solutions may be, he is offering voters a bridge to the past. That's the Rahm Emanuel argument. Well, guess what? Rahm Emanuel is more out of step with his party than is Bernie Sanders. Forgetting the labels. Jim in Sheboygan, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
So it's kind of interesting as I watch Sanders rise in the polls and the whole election cycle. I go back to 2010 when the Tea Party was fighting with the Republican Party, and basically the Tea Party, the Never Trumpers weren't doing what the Tea Party wanted, so they got into Congress. They got a candidate that in Trump that they could support, and the party supported them. So basically, I see Bloomberg as a Never Sanders, and it's the same thing that happened to the Republicans is now happening to the Democrats, but on the left. And Sanders is the Trump for the Democrats. That's kind of how I see it. But I'll listen to your comments.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comparison. I do. I think that because it didn't get settled out in 2016 with Hillary being the nominee and the way that she became the nominee, because there was no real reckoning like there was with the Tea Party-led takeover of the House in 2010. There was no reckoning in 2012, your presidential nominee, because there was nobody who really fit well enough to depose Romney. That reckoning was just pushed off 4 years. And when it's pushed off, it gets that much more intense. If there's a true frustration that is exacerbated by the continuing fecklessness, the continuing dismissal of those frustrations and exasperations. And so 2010 to 2012 to 2016, there is a trajectory there to Trump. And is there a similar trajectory, even though Obama is not that far in the distance? He seems like it, doesn't he? So is there a similar trajectory from, you know, a lot of disappointment, even among Obama voters in 2012, to then 2016 with where is our populist reckoning, the form that we want it to take, and now 4 years after that? Yeah, I think there is some symmetry there.
Nevada caucuses are tomorrow. And guess who Bernie's bringing out to try to get the Latino vote, the Latinos?
Would that be AOC?
Congressman Chuy Garcia.
Oh,
he's
sure.
He's in Nevada with him. Yeah, he's such a force to be reckoned with.
Scintillating. Tom in Deer Park.
Do you see the possibility of a brokered convention? And do you see the possibility of the Bernie Bros descending on Milwaukee and making the riots in 1968 look like child's play?
I wouldn't put it
past them. They're brutal. I mean, they are... Yeah. Sick people that should be behind bars.
Well, who?
Some Bernie bros.
Well, yeah, there's definitely a...
People living in hiding because they attacked Bernie online. And they all fought back and made their lives...
Yeah, you know. I know. Death threats and mean tweets. Yeah,
You could handle that. I could handle that, but some people can't. They just hide in holes.
There's some definite thuggery out there. I mean, the Bernie Bros. Look, the undercover interviews by James O'Keefe's people who have detailed Bernie campaign operatives, actually field operatives, their fascination with gulags and re-educating Trump voters and so on and so forth. So there's some scary stuff there. There's no question. I'm not discounting it. Are they going to descend on Milwaukee and turn it into 68 in Chicago? Nah. I don't know. I don't think that's clear yet. You know, I don't want to extrapolate from a couple of incidents. I get the mentality, mm-hmm. and that is disturbing. But a couple of incidents, that incident at his rally the other day. And I don't want to get into the business either of holding politicians accountable for what unhinged supporters do. So some Trump supporter starts a fight in the stands at a MAGA rally, and that's happened infrequently, but it's happened. Is Trump responsible for that? No. Is Bernie Sanders responsible for the guy who shot up the softball game of the GOP members of Congress? No, he's not. He's not advocating for that. I mean, he's advocating for a very violent philosophy at its core, socialism. So he is a violent person because he's advocating for tyranny. But that's not the same thing as saying, you, Bernie bro, go attack that person. That's where culpability comes in. Vince in Waukegan.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. Now, the reason Bernie's popular is because he sticks to his guns. He doesn't waffle around like the rest of the Democrats, whichever way the wind blows. And that's the same thing that got Trump elected. You know, so hopefully in the future some politicians actually learn something from this and they learn to be principled.
Well, thanks for the call, Vince. I mean, that's no doubt that's part of the appeal. And let me say something else, too, that's been underappreciated, and which I mentioned at the outset. Bernie always had an advantage going into this race from running in 2016. All these other candidates, with the exception of Bloomberg, whose money can telescope infrastructure, had to start from the ground up. Bernie had tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, really, of small dollar donors that were already in the fold. His campaign from 2016 never stopped. So he had personnel, he had a strong donor base, and he had, you know, certainly higher than the rest of the field name ID. So those are a lot of advantages going in. And the reason that they stuck with him is because that frustration among the socialist base of the Democrat Party is real. I mean, look how far they've gone and how quickly they've gone. So much of this campaign, as a number of pundits have remarked upon, has been litigating all the disappointments of the Obama years. He didn't go hard enough, left fast enough. Bill in Edison Park.
Yeah, Maxine Waters, she openly told the dummies to go to restaurants when you see somebody wearing a Trump hat or whatever. go in their face and tell them to get, you're not wanted here, and that these people are throwing coffee and throwing food at these, spitting at these people. She should be, she should be held accountable. That's right. Not the, I agree with you. The other ones, they just put, they don't like their views, but she's promoting it. She's telling these idiots to go do that crap. All right, that's enough.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Yeah,
I think she's toned it down though.
Yeah, she's yeah.
Because they put her in her corner. Remember, they wouldn't let her talk to the media. She was in a timeout, so to speak.
Yeah, and I think all that stuff should be litigated in this campaign come the fall. All of people need to be reminded of Maxine Waters' comments about go. You see some Trump administration official, harass them. You throw them out. You know, get them thrown out of the restaurant. You know, this is about yeah, making the lives of people with whom you disagree miserable. That's what we want to do. That's what she said. There's no question that she advocated that. Peggy Noonan on the debate, she, like you, Amy, was enraptured by the debate. Best Democrat debate in years, writes Peggy Noonan. Yeah.
It was amazing. 20 million people watched it, too. Well, so I'm not alone. It was one of the most watched debates of the season.
Why did they watch it?
Because Bloomberg entered the race finally. And they attacked him, and Bloomberg did a poor job, I think, of defending himself. But they get to do it all over again next week in South Carolina.
Yeah, we'll see what the drop-off is after they've gotten a hard look at Bloomberg.
I can't wait.
Here's how Noonan synthesizes the argument made by Bloomberg and Sanders, the competing arguments made by the two, in one sentence. Mike Bloomberg is saying, you can stomach me. And Bernie Sanders is saying, you can stomach socialism. Interesting. I think, and she goes on to provide a little bit more of a, you know, how she would craft it for a, to develop that you can stomach me. For Bloomberg, she says, you know, he basically should say how he would deliver you can stomach me in ways that are a little bit more complimentary to oneself. I'm a businessman. I was mayor of New York. I'm liberal in every way, but I'm not insane. I've got the resources to meet and surpass Trump's fundraising powerhouse. I'm not fancy, and I'm no poet, although he is a little fancy, actually. I'm not fancy, and I'm no poet, but I can lead and I can win. You're right, I can't buy the nomination. That's why I'm here on the trail every day asking for your support. And his effect would be, you know, kind of up for the battle, happy to be in the fight. That's the market position, the tonality he wants to convey. For Bernie Sanders, she writes, here's how he would make the case you can stomach socialism. You know, there's something wrong with the economic system and has been for a long time. The inequality is wild. The injustice all around us, you can feel it. And it's cowardice to say there's nothing we can do about it. His effect, I'm the last lion. You know my roar. You know something else. I have the power of the man who means it. Yeah. I think that I'd say I'm 80% with her on the way that they would, what they're trying to convey and how they best convey it. And I'll tell you what, that matchup in this environment, you can stomach me versus you can stomach socialism, that matchup accrues to the benefit of Bernie Sanders. And it's another reason why, or another way to think about why, you have both Trump and his pollster, Tony Fabrizio, saying, all else being equal, we're happy to take on Bloomberg and his money. We'd rather take on Bloomberg and his money than Bernie.
And if you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and this piece from Brett Stevens in the New York Times earlier in the week. Stevens, a never-Trumper, although having to reevaluate being a never-Trumper against the prospects of a Bernie or a Warren nomination because of what their plans would mean for the U.S. economy. Interesting piece he wrote a couple weeks back, we discussed. his most recent piece, Whisper Networks, Trump's Whisper Networks, as you have Trump's approval rating hovering right about 50%, according to a number of polling outfits now, including Gallup. Stevens writes, his support could be even bigger because of these Trump Whisper Networks, as our culture has become more censorious, as social media has done more cracking down on Trump supporters in particular, conservatives generally, Trump supporters in particular. It doesn't eliminate those people's views. It just drives them underground. And I just sort of wanted to test that out. In your network, you know, your circles of influence, do you find a lot of silent Trump supporters, people that are definitively going to vote for Trump? They're just not going to talk about it for fear of the repercussions in the increasingly censorious American culture. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Yeah, I mean, I've lost friends over my support for Trump. I used to be invited to getaways in Michigan and things like that, and that all stopped when President Trump was elected.
Well, that speaks to the censorious culture. So what about
people? And then people always come up and say, I'm a Trump supporter. They'll just find you, let you know.
Yeah.
Some at church, some at East Bank Club, they'll just let you know. Like, I listen to your show. It's okay. You don't have to whisper. Nobody's around. We're not being recorded. I love those conversations in the underneath garage.
You know, it's hard to measure because they won't allow themselves to be measured. But so it's all anecdotal. I understand that. But it's still interesting, and I have those experiences a lot, too. People
Oh, yeah.
You wouldn't think necessarily or you don't know that are quiet Trump supporters, quiet because they either want to be because it's just their nature, or quiet because they feel they need to be because they're not in a position to be exposed and face professional or personal repercussions, which is a sad commentary, but it doesn't make it any less real. Trump was in Colorado Springs, fresh off his rally in Phoenix the other day.
It was a graduation for felons who are trying to get indoctrinated back to normal society. It was really sweet. It was cool.
He had this to say about the Oscars. Just Trump being Trump. I know he's going to comment on pop culture. He is a consumer of pop culture.
This wasn't in front of the felons, by the way.
No, this was at the rally.
That was at the rally.
Yeah, it was rally supporters, yeah. Fresh off his rally in Phoenix for supporters, yeah. And then he had other stops in Colorado, as you mentioned. Here's latent commentary on the Best Picture victor in this year's Oscars.
Bad with the Academy Awards this year, did you see it? And the winner is a movie from South Korea. What the hell was that all about? We got enough problems with South Korea, with trade. On top of it, they give him the best movie of the year. Was it good? I don't know. You know, I'm looking for, like, where let's get Gone with the Wind. Can we get, like, Gone with the Wind back, please? Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, Sunset Boulevard.
So many great movies. The winner is from South Korea. I thought it was best foreign film, right? Best foreign movie. No, it was the button. Did this ever happen before?
No, it hasn't happened before, but
yeah, it
happened now.
Clearly, I don't think he saw Parasite, but that's conjecture on my part.
Well, he said it was a good, I don't know.
Okay.
It could be interpreted one of two ways, right? I don't know because I didn't see it, or I don't know because I'm ambivalent about it after seeing it. I don't know. But, I mean, I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille. Nobody's a bigger fan of all of Bill Holden's work and Sunset Boulevard in particular than me. So, hey, you know, hey, I'm with you, Mr. President. Gloria Swanson, Bill Holden, great. I'm with you on Gone with the Wind, too. Less so than actually Sunset Boulevard. But
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. We actually watched it yesterday.
I know.
Me and Peyton and Eli, and yeah. I fast-forwarded through the naughty scenes. But because no mom has to sit through that with her sons. But I love the movie. I thought it was, it really sparked some conversations about which characters should have died and shouldn't have died. Spoiler alert. Sorry if you haven't seen it. But mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was, as I said on the show, it was my vote for Best Picture.
Yep.
It actually handled class in a very textured way that was different than the expected caricatures you get of rich people and poor people from Hollywood. There were some really pretty good plot twists. I thought, again, of the offerings, 1917 was good. I think Parasite was a step up.
Yeah.
In terms of the quality of movie. And so, I know he's just riffing and he's trying to add color to these things. You don't talk just about dry policy issues. You want to add some flavor to it, talk about pop culture and this and that. I don't know. It's just weird to me. It's just such a weird tangent. And he has these weird moments. And we have enough problems with South Korea. I mean, South Korea is an ally.
Exactly. I know. Talking about trade.
You know, we have U.S. troops
stationed there.
Stationed
have
there.
Been since decades.
Since the end of the Korean War. So it's just bizarre. And, of course, this is going to be amplified and it's going to be, it's going to bring race into it. And you already had a response from the producers of Parasite saying, of course, he didn't like it because he can't read. Obviously, it's subtitled.
Yeah, it's subtitled.
I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's just silly. It's silly all the way around. I hate that we have to talk about it, but I mean, he's the one that made the bizarre comment. I don't know. I get he's trying to be funny or something.
I think he's trying to be funny.
Yeah, I know.
And everybody should go see the movie Parasite. So good. So how do you like the ending? What did you think? Well,
Joe in Hinsdale. Hey, Joe.
Joe, you're on. Hello.
Thank you. I couldn't agree any more with you guys. You know, I have a lot of friends who don't speak up because I think Democrats try to suppress their voices, shout over, where I think a lot of the times my Republican friends take the high road, especially over the Obama years. And the best analogy I could really think of is, Trump kind of reminds me a little bit of McDonald's. You know, McDonald's is still the largest chain in the world. 70 million people eat there a day, but yet nobody sort of admits it. So there's this absolute phenomenon that's going on, and you could see the surge in the polls. Look at all the polls that are coming out. You mentioned the 50%. All the polls now are breaking towards Trump's favor. You have arenas filling up. You have them at the big NASCAR event. You have them at the LSU game. People are chanting for Trump. You're seeing it in the ratings with the State of the Union, and there is an absolute surge that's going on right now. And all this is going to lead to is I think Democrats have completely misplayed their cards, and they're going to lose the House. And Trump is rallying these supports. He's out west right now in these huge rallies, drawing lines and lines of people in and the chants. So I think the base is fired up like it's never been fired before, and it's going to be fun come November time. So those are my comments. I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for the call, Joe. I like the McDonald's analogy, right? It's the largest fast food franchise in the world, and nobody in America eats there. Yeah,
right, just go through the drive-thru and, make sure. No cars around you look familiar?
I think he's also onto something about the Democrats so wildly overplaying their hands. And also their predictions about Trump, their accusations against Trump, most of which the seminal ones about his fitness for office and whether or not he should be, have fallen flat. Their predictions about the end of days if Trump were to be elected or after he was elected have all fallen flat. I mean, at some point, even among people who have a distaste for Trump in terms of personality, you have to look at what the other side is offering and say, well, I just can't be on that side. I just can't be with them. That is so far afield from what I believe, what good sense looks like, the kind of society in which I want to live. I can't be with them. Dan in Palos.
Yeah, good morning, Amy. Good morning, Dan. I can't tell you where I work at. However, I do work with a lot of city employees, and a lot of them are diehard Trump supporters. they just are not coming out and speaking about it is because of the repercussions. And those that do are on the fence, I ask them a question. You raise your kids to defend yourself. Sometimes Trump rhetoric, he's defending himself. I says, also, I says, with these socialists coming in and these taxes are being raised, I says, your 401k is in these corporations. Your unions invest in these corporations that they want to take down. How do you like that? How do you like to retire earlier than in another 10 years? That's all I have to say, Dan.
Thanks for the call, Dan. Appreciate that. Yeah, I think there's a lot of that. I think Brett Stevens, remember, Brett Stevens, his posture is never Trump. But I, despite that, I think he's pointing up a real dynamic. Yemi on the north side.
Hi, good morning, guys.
Morning. Good morning.
I think I believe the fact that the South Korea thing is bizarre, but notwithstanding, I live in a community of Nigerian black, especially my church. I literally, it was high and hot, one other lady that voted for Trump in the last election. I can tell you now that I've identified about 6 folks that will vote Trump in the next election, and other folks that I've talked to, about 15. I don't know if they're going to vote for Trump, but they think he's going to win in the next election. Thank you.
Interesting. Thanks for the call, Yemi. Yeah, I appreciate that. There's a lot of that, and there's not a lot of the other. Anecdotal, again, but you op-eds, and we've talked to some of those op-ed writers that that Bernie Sanders supporter, the psychologist we spoke with earlier in the week. A lot of you, who the Democrats have moved from her being a Democrat to her being a registered independent in New Hampshire. Not a Trump voter, but she's not going to just take whatever the Democrat Party gives her. A lot of people, I didn't vote for Trump in 2016, but I'm going to vote for him now. I didn't vote for Trump in 2016, but I'm not comfortable with where the Democrats are. There's not a lot of people saying, I voted for Trump in 16, and boy, am I disappointed, I can't do it again. Where are those op-eds? Where are those voters? I voted for him in 16.
I haven't read one article on that.
but even too, the same thing, in your networks. Anybody who said, I begrudgingly voted, or even I enthusiastically voted for Trump in 16, and I can't do it again. I want to meet those people. Because you hear almost nothing going in the other direction, which is also telling. Marty in Naperville.
I'm on a great show as usual. Two things. Number one, as far as this foreign movie, you got to remember, all those people in Hollywood are cool. That's why they voted for that, even though they really snubbed themselves, but that's beside the point. Second of all, my wife and I, being Trump supporters, her family will not even acknowledge that she's in a room if we get together with them because they are stout Illinois Democrats that don't even vote, by the way. But
good.
How dare you vote Republican in this state? So, yeah, we live that every time we go to a family get-together. And my problem is, like I think it was Bill Ingvall said, although I have the right to remain silent, I do not have the ability, so I am outlawed. So that probably doesn't help.
That's
the way life is now.
Thanks for the call, Marty. I hate to pull rank on you, but I am a bit of a blue-collar comedy tour expert. Recognized.
That's right. You're going to be at Zany's this weekend, or in Vernon Hills?
No. I am not a comedian. I'm an academic of comedians.
Oh.
See, it's different. And so I know I have the right to remain silent, but I don't have the ability, or I didn't have the ability. That is a line from Ron White, not Bill Ingvall. Yeah.
Okay.
I just want to make sure we set the record straight. I don't want to get static from Larry the Cable Guy on it. George and Lyle.
Yeah, hi. So I wanted to say that while I agree Trump's a little inarticulate, I think it really was an indictment on Hollywood. When Hollywood has to go to an international film to pick the best picture, I think that's just a way of him slamming Hollywood.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that's interesting. All right. Thanks for the call, George. That's an interesting interpretation. I didn't pick up on we can't even make – Hollywood can't even make a film. It's actually – so that's interesting. I just didn't receive it that way, but I could see that. We talked to well, this is the subject of Ross Douthat's new book, New York Times columnist. And I think we, one of either this show or my other show, We talked about
something with Dan Proft.
Yeah, something I know I was talking about it. Some Peter Thiel's review of Ross Douthat's book at First Things. And he makes the point about Hollywood reviewing Douthat's book, which also makes the point. Everything's remakes. Where's the authentic culture of the 2010s and the 20 and now on the cusp of the 2020s, the 21st century, the way that you had authentic culture in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, distinctive music and movies that were original. In this century, so much of it is recycled, remakes. And so was he saying something about the lack of ingenuity in Hollywood with respect to American-made films? Okay. All right. Maybe. Greg, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Dan and Amy. I just want to remind people, back in 2016, for those of us who live in deep blue states who say that our votes don't matter, popular vote. If everybody in all these deep blue states had voted the way they should have, instead of staying at home saying, oh, well, doesn't matter, we may not have had this popular vote issue we had in 2016.
All right. Thanks for the call, Greg. Well, even more importantly, and to Joe from Hinsdale's point earlier, you come out and vote. Come out and vote for Trump as a protest vote to the Chicago Democrats, surrender Republican power structure in the state. But in addition to that, if you want to see Republicans take over the House and have Trump have a second term that has Republican control of Congress so that more can be accomplished, then you've got two races in particular in the suburbs that matter. Jeannie Ives versus Sean Casten. Mm-hmm. That's a pickup opportunity, and whoever emerges from that primary to face Lauren Underwood out further west, that's a pickup opportunity. Steven in Lake Geneva.
Say, buddy, I was in Madison the other day at a lawn and garden show, and it's very liberal there, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. I wore my Trump 2020 hat. There wasn't another one in the whole place, and it was packed. But I had at least 50 people come up to me privately and say they liked my hat. So they're out there.
All right. Thanks, Stephen.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This is a great topic. This is what I got into radio to do, to talk about the big ideas, not just the banality of electoral politics. Zach Beauchamp writing in Vox.com. That's a left-wing outlet. Identity politics isn't hurting liberalism, it's saving it. More identity politics. What the critics lambaste as an attack on liberalism, identity politics, is actually its best form. The logical extension of liberalism's core commitment to social equality and democracy adapted to address modern sources of inequality, writes Beauchamp. A liberalism that rejects identity politics is a liberalism for the powerful, one that relegates the interests of marginalized groups to second-class status. To say that liberalism and identity politics are at odds is to misunderstand our political situation. Identity politics isn't merely compatible with liberalism. It is, in fact, liberalism's truest face. If liberalism wishes to succeed in the 21st century, it shouldn't reject identity politics. It should embrace it. That's Zach Beauchamp. And this Vox.com is supposed to be sort of on the vanguard of left thought in America. That's the lesson that Zach Beauchamp and I would say cultural Marxists in his ranks are taking away from the electoral results in the West over the last 4 years, from the U.S. to the U.K., Brexit and Boris, to the devastating election results for the left in France, in Italy, the Netherlands, Germany. Okay. So just in case you thought, well, you know, the moderate play, those who don't want to go, you know, full gender as a social construct. There's got to be some give there, right? No. Nope. Wrong. entitlements and burdens based on race or gender or orientation or identification. That can't be sustained, can it? That can't be what the left is really about, is it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pretty much. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Eric Kaufman, professor of politics at Birkbeck College, University of London, and author of the book White Shift, Populism, Immigration, and the Future of White Majorities. And he has also penned a provocative piece at lawliberty.org on the left and why the left is losing. Eric, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's great to be here, Dan.
Do you subscribe to my reaction to Zach Beauchamp's argument in favor of identity politics?
Well, I think it's you know, a bit suicidal for left-wing parties to go that route. And I think, as you said, if we just look at the results, you know, the Labour Party here in the recent British election got their worst result since 1935. And as you mentioned, the French, the Danish, and the Italian left, main left parties have had their worst results ever, and similarly in Germany and Sweden, and some of the worst results even going back to 1908. So really, this shift from talking about class and economics and economic redistribution to talking about identity politics and culture has really not paid dividends for the left at all. And so I think it's probably a very bad strategy.
And you develop that a little bit more, why they can't move away from what Zach Beauchamp is arguing that they do. You reference David Goodhart, who recently said it's easier for right-wing parties to move left on economics than left-wing parties to move right on culture. Why is that?
Well, the key here, I think, is a kind of political correctness and taboos that emerge within activist circles in the left, which are very important in parties such as the Labour Party. So the Labour Party is largely controlled by a sort of activist group called Momentum, who very much buy into identity politics. And it's not just that some people believe in something like trans, that the idea that gender is something that you just self-identify with and is not connected to biology, but it's that they can then make that a taboo, so you can be expelled from the party if you don't sign up to this creed. And this is something that, even since their devastating loss, they've been tearing themselves apart over the trans issue. It sort of indicates that this purity spiral is driven by these taboos. So it's not just a matter of switching from economic to cultural identity issues, but it's also a matter of taboos which act as force multipliers and actually make it impossible for moderates, even if they disagree, to express those views.
It seems to me that the left, and this is an argument, so I'd be interested, maybe this is too conventional, the argument is the left is always playing the long game. They recognize that, yeah, it may be an insular minority of people in America or in the West right now that think gender is a social construct and that you shouldn't have rights conferred or privileges really conferred based on how you identify in terms of your gender. We understand that we're in the minority now, but we also understand that if we continue to relentlessly make the case and relentlessly impose our will within the cultural institutions that we largely control, that over time, a generation or two, we'll have the same success in imposing our orthodoxy that we have had, say, for example, with redefinition of marriage and the gay rights movement.
Yeah, and I think that is a powerful argument, and I know, I mean, there's a writer called Ed West who has a book out coming out in a couple of weeks, which makes that exact argument, that the right tends to win elections, but they tend to lose the culture. And I think that has been the pattern, and you're right that the cultural institutions, universities, and media and so on have become progressively captured by the progressive left. And so it is an open question as to whether the strategy might win culturally. And I don't think it's clear which way that's going to go. I would say one of the things you see in the young population is a growing split between people who, let's say, favor free speech over emotional safety, and then the other side favors emotional safety. So I think their arguments are getting some traction amongst that youngest cohort, but it's not clear that it's convincing everybody. But I agree with you that they do seem to be more successful in marching through the cultural institutions than they do in winning elections. It's just that right now, and certainly for the foreseeable future, for the Labour Party to win pushing these themes is essentially going to be impossible for decades. So I think they're going to have a rethink, or they're simply going to be out of power.
Are they more in danger of self-elimination on those issues, like we're talking about, the using the trans issue as an example of a cultural issue, or on a matter like immigration, which you write about in your new book, White Shift? Where that is more than just a cultural issue, it's also a public safety issue, properly conceived and argued, and the idea that they can stake out a position as extreme as, say, the left in this country talking about the elimination of such a thing as an illegal immigrant, because there should be no such thing as a border, so there can be no such thing as an illegal border crossing, and we should also eliminate a border enforcement agencies like ICE as well, and Customs and Border Protection. Staking out such an extreme position on that issue seems to me like it may be more dangerous electorally for the left than staking out the trans issue.
You're right, yeah. So immigration is an issue that a lot of voters care about in Europe and in Britain. And it's Labour's inability to speak to that, which helped them lose the election, just as it was the people who wanted to remain in the European Union, their inability to address people's worries about free migration from the European Union that also cost the Remain side the Brexit referendum. So, yeah, that is the key issue. And in fact, in the book, I really talk about how immigration is really becoming the key battleground in Western countries, partly because they're undergoing ethnocultural shifts in which ethnic majorities are declining, and it's in that context that the immigration issue rises up people's agendas. And what you see is that as immigration numbers rose in Europe and in Britain, immigration rose up people's priority lists and started to actually shape elections in a serious way. So, and of course, part of the problem for the left is it seems as though voters who are motivated by wanting less immigration are more likely to switch party to go to conservative parties than voters who are pro-immigration but well-off. So that kind of pro-immigration, well-off person who voted to remain in the European Union, fewer of them went over to the Labour Party. So in that exchange on immigration, a pro-immigration position tends to lose you votes. And I think there's something similar happened in the U.S. too, in terms of committed people who wanted less immigration went over to Trump in a way that the pro-immigration conservative voters did not go over to Clinton in the same way. So again, that exchange seems to go more for the conservative voters. And that's kind of another reason why the left taking a very pro-immigration position is arguably shooting itself in the foot.
Sean Rosenberg, who's a sociologist at UC Irvine, recently penned a paper suggesting that the end of democracy in the West is upon us. It's going to be replaced, per these most recent election results, with a populist right-wing regimes that are going to be authoritarian. And the reason that they're so popular is because that they offer simple solutions to very complex problems. I mean, that there are gaping blind spots in his argument, as far as I'm concerned. But but talking about easy arguments for complex problems. But I wanted to just get to your reaction. Like, there, so now, because these center right populist parties have been successful electorally in the recent years, we're on this march away from democracy and towards right wing authoritarianism.
Well, I think the problem here is that there is a genuine grievance that these populist parties are bringing to the table. In some ways, they are strengthening democracy by bringing neglected interests in. So when the mainstream parties, for reasons of political correctness, weren't willing to talk about immigration, if we take Sweden prior to 2014, the interior minister tried to raise the subject of immigration levels, was sort of attacked in the media and by other politicians as a racist for doing that. And then the next year, the Sweden Democrats, the populist right party, were up to first 13% and then up to 25%. And actually now the mainstream parties are talking about immigration. So actually that introduced an issue that nobody wanted to talk about. And so it actually strengthened democracy. Now, of course, you do get populists, who are negative in some ways in terms of attacking the independence of the judiciary and so on in the media. So there are negatives to some degree in Poland and Hungary, but equally it's important to recognize that I think the liberal left side of the equation has also caused this problem by sort of, you know, their influence in liberal institutions such as the judiciary or the media, and then using those positions to pursue an activist policy. What that does is it discredits those institutions in the eyes of voters who don't share those liberal preferences. So by using institutions such as the European Union or the judiciary to advance a kind of progressive form of politics, that has been as much a cause of this loss of trust or legitimacy as populist politicians. And that's the part that I don't see a lot of progressive commentators owning up to as much. There are a few people who have pointed this out, but again, there doesn't seem to be the willingness to sort of admit the part that progressive overreach within elite institutions has played in the polarization and populism story.
He is Eric Hoffman. He's a professor of politics at Birkbeck College, University of London, author of the book White Shift, Populism, Immigration, and the Future of White Majorities. And also check out his piece, which I'll tweet out, Why the Left is Losing. That's at lawliberty.org. Professor Kaufman, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Take care.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and Amy, trouble in Erlacher land. I mean, Brian got out of here a long time ago. He can't sell his place because of the property taxes. Casey Erlacher,
who's the mayor of Mettawa.
Mettawa, up in Lake County.
Eric Hahn called it Mettawa yesterday, well, like three times.
You always got to be careful in Illinois because they're, you know, there are towns like
Madsen or Madison.
Cairo, it's at Cairo.
Cairo, Marseilles or Marcellus.
No, right. Marseille.
Marseille.
But it's actually Marcellus.
Right.
And, you know, down in, what was that?
One time I was at Millikan University, and I think it was Mark Saxmar. He goes, reporting live from Decatur. I'm like, it's Decatur.
Right, yeah.
Or Bourbonus, it's Bourbonnais.
Well, anyway, we're not talking about the unique pronunciations of Illinois towns. So I'm talking about Casey Erlacher, who's been indicted as part of a conspiracy that was running an illegal gambling business, allegedly, accused as acting for an agent for this gambling ring, recruiting bettors that would use an offshore website as the way to communicate. The bookies would communicate the information, the bettors would bet on that site, and then they do cash transactions here.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. If he does not get a new trial, he being Roger Stone, should President Trump pardon him? President Trump reacting yesterday after Roger Stone, a former associate and longtime political gadfly, was sentenced to 40 months in federal prison per his various convictions for process crimes associated with the Mueller-Russian collusion investigation.
Even though President Trump was on the West Coast, he was following the sentencing very closely.
And Roger's definitely a character. I'm following this very closely, and I want to see it play out. How can you have a jury pool tainted so badly? It's not fair. It's not fair. And, you know, it's not happening to a lot of other people. They say he lied. But other people lied, too. Just to mention, Comey lied. McCabe lied. You don't know who these people are? Just trust me. They all lied.
A good piece in thehill.com by Mark Penn, who's a former Hillary Clinton pollster. He says, I am no fan of Stone's tactics and history. I am a fan of an FBI and a DOJ that treat everyone equally. Yeah, that's where I'm at, too. And that's the rub. The rub isn't about Roger Stone necessarily, other than Roger Stone is an example of, and another example of, the apparent existence of two systems of justice. And that's a real problem that extends well beyond Roger Stone or any other individual in the political drama that has unfolded in Washington over the last 3 years. For more on this topic and a few others, we're pleased to be joined again by Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, of course, host of Special Report, weekdays 5 p.m. Chicago time, and author of the just-released book, 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win World War II. Brett, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Morning.
Is that your sense of where President Trump is at? He's taking a wait-and-see attitude pending the possibility of a retrial because of a tainted jury?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's essentially tipped his hand that he's watching it and that he's said that he thinks Roger Stone has been treated unfairly. I think you're right to point out that his mindset is in the two-tiered system of justice, and he sees, you know, the Comeys, the McCabes, the, you know, even the Clappers, who many people directly said that they lied under oath or lied in investigations and don't, you know, there's no moving forward on those fronts. So I think that's where his head is. I don't know whether he's going to pardon them or not. If I had any indication, if the exoneration through the retrial doesn't happen, I bet he would.
And, you know, part of it is going back to Hillary Clinton, too. Just going back to Mark Penn's piece, he reminds us, reviewing some other lies told by others in the Trump and Hillary Clinton investigations, not prosecuted. Hillary Clinton's aides denied to the FBI they knew about her private email server, for example. They knew it existed, even though they later turned out to be partially responsible for maintaining it. And the employee at Platte River Networks that attempted to destroy emails after they were subpoenaed and lied to the FBI, his punishment for both of those acts was immunity. That's very disparate treatment for him, just as an example from Hillary world, as compared to the George Papadopoulos's and the Michael Flynn, whether you're talking about current matters like McCabe and Comey and the rest in FBI or intelligence agencies, or even going back to 2016 and the Hillary Clinton email investigation by the FBI.
Yeah, I think there are many examples, and there's a lot of frustration, especially on the part of the president. There are some political considerations here. My understanding is that if Stone was pardoned and then he was called up to Capitol Hill to testify, he could no longer plead the Fifth about some of the questions that he would be asked. You know, there is that, and you would have to trust Roger Stone as a political operative, which is a dangerous prospect.
Yes, that's fair. Yes.
Be much-watched TV, must-watch TV, I should say. What about Roger Stone's relationship with WikiLeaks?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the extent of it. There were definitely communications, and, you know, that's where all of this centers, is what he said to investigators about his connection and his knowledge of WikiLeaks and the DNC email leak. So I don't think we know the bottom line about that. And Roger Stone is, you know, he's fairly unsavory character. He's definitely an interesting character. But his defense said that he was more braggadocious and making up stuff than he was sinister.
Sticking in this whole area of the investigations into Trump world, Russia is back in the news. The assertion by Trump's outgoing DNI, Joseph McGuire, that Russia is intending to try to intercede in the 2020 election on behalf of Trump, and also the reporting that this is the reason that McGuire is out and Richard Grenell is in as acting DNI, with the possibility of Doug Collins being installed as the ultimate DNI. Trey Gowdy said, according to his sources, the idea that Trump is was upset with McGuire and he pushed him out, that is not the case. Trey Gowdy saying on your channel there, Fox, my sources tell me that he was not upset, that this was a move that was coming anyway. He just happened to go with Ambassador Grenell instead of Representative Chris Stewart or other qualified candidates. What's your handle on it?
I mean, that's our reporting. John Roberts is reporting that you know, McGuire was on his way out March 11th, I think it was his final day. He was not in the running for the permanent position. And that, as far as whether, you know, the level of anger, you can kind of take a number of 0 to 10 about, you know, the president's being upset about something. John Roberts is reporting that it was not this big dust up that it was made to be in the New York Times. However, you know, the storyline that Russia is trying to interfere in the 2020 election should not be a surprise to anybody. We've right. heard testimony to that on Capitol Hill. It's happened. It's happening. It happened in 2018. The issue is whether the briefing up on Capitol Hill, what that looked like. And I'm told that there was a lot of questioning, very skeptical about some of the sourcing of some of the things the DNI was saying, to the point where some Republicans thought that it was kind of more of a staged thing with all these DNI folks up there in order for it to leak, which it did. So it's kind of like a vicious circle.
Well, do you think Trump is, you know, worried that the Democrats are going to weaponize this information against him?
Yeah. I mean, yes, he's watched it from for 2.5 years. He watched the impeachment effort. That said, we should all be concerned about Russia's potential interference. And politics aside, that's not a good thing. The other question is, you know, if it's Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders is for, you know, green everything. We, under as a country under President Trump, are producing a lot of oil and doing some things that are not that great for Russia. So if you look at just the bottom line, who would they want? You know, there's some questions there, too. And that's some of the Republican questioning, I'm told, up on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, I mean, Bernie Sanders may want their support, the old Soviet support, you know, since he enjoyed his honeymoon there and had such great things to say about the Soviet Union in the 80s. He may want their support, but they just may not be ready to give it to him much as he would want it. You don't need to comment on that. It's just a smart-ass comment.
I won't.
Yeah. But speaking of Sanders versus Trump, you got the Nevada caucus tomorrow, of course, and Bernie seems to have a fairly comfortable lead. It's important to note that, you've reported on it, of course, but a lot of people don't appreciate it. It's not like the Iowa caucus. About half of those who are going to cast their votes in Nevada have already done so because there's an early voting component to the Nevada caucus. But I was talking yesterday evening on another show with a columnist for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and he was saying that you have a very good likelihood of a repeat of Iowa, maybe worse, when it comes to reporting the results.
Yeah, well, the DNC said it might take – we're not going to get same-day results.
Because they're using a new app after they scuttled one of the developers that was responsible for the app use in Iowa, and they just were training election judges – on this new app that's going to be used to tabulate the results as of Tuesday of this week.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's heinous. I mean, the fact that you're getting to this point, you know, it's not like the election is popping up on you. Like you're kind of like, wait, it's the election. It's been on the calendar for a little while. And I really have talked to some Democratic officials who are just pulling their hair out. The fact that they kind of made this app in Iowa, and now they made this app in Nevada and didn't go to Silicon Valley or somebody who actually works on some of this stuff, and instead are rolling the dice. And it'll be a shame if it's another repeat of Iowa, because only thing it'll do is empower and embolden the Sanders folks who say they're trying to take it away from us. And that's really the narrative that's sticking.
And the dumb establishment types, Rahm Emanuel with another op-ed in the Wall Street Journal decrying Bernie Sanders yesterday, they have a real problem that they're trying to paper over. They're trying to make sure nobody notices. And the problem is that Bernie Sanders has a high floor but a low ceiling argument doesn't square with the data. And the data indicates that, yeah, there may be 3/4 of the Democrat primary electorate that have another candidate right now. But if Bernie piles up victories and a delegate count, 70% of likely Democrat primary voters have a favorable impression of Bernie Sanders. The idea that they're unwilling to fold in with Bernie Sanders if he wins these primaries and caucuses fair and square, as the Rahm Emanuels of the world are trying to tell people, it just doesn't square with the information.
No. In fact, you know, Bernie Sanders is the second choice for a lot of those moderate choices. Like, so say an Amy Klobuchar or a Pete Buttigieg, their voters, sometimes the second choice is Bernie Sanders. and he's high on that list, so it doesn't make any sense. And when you get past Super Tuesday, 38% of the delegates will have already been distributed. 38%. So you have a big chunk left, but proportionally, because that's how it goes all the way to Milwaukee, Sanders has a better than even chance of either getting the nomination outright or going into Milwaukee with a plurality and the argument that I got the most, not the magic number, but the most.
I know. I'm sure you watched the debate. Bloomberg got buried. He's not even on the ballot in Nevada. But he's really taken, you know, everyone's focused on him. That's why 20 million people watched the debate. Can he bounce back from that horrible debate?
Yes, because money talks. And, you know, no matter how many people watch that debate, many more people have seen his commercials and ads. And he's got 100 offices in Texas. You know, he's got offices in Arkansas. So, yes, he can bounce back. It was really poor, the performance, and you would think with all that money that maybe a couple of debate prep people would have been a good investment, but it was not. And he's got another one on Tuesday, and we'll see what he brings to the table. But, yes, he can bounce back just because of the money.
But how damaging was that to his standing with political insiders looking for the Bernie alternative?
Pretty damaging.
Yeah.
Pretty damaging because on a number of fronts. He came off sometimes smarmy about his wealth and the NDA stuff, and which Elizabeth Warren is really hitting. She came out last night in a town hall on CNN and said, and had a contract.
Yeah. Sign this, Bernie.
Sign this.
I mean, Bloomberg.
Yeah, and yeah, Mayor Bloomberg. I think it was very damaging. He can bounce back, but I think the biggest winner is Bernie Sanders, and ultimately the biggest winner is Donald Trump. As all of this plays out.
He is Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, hosts a special report, 5 p.m. Chicago time, weekdays. Author of the just-released book, 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win World War II. Brett, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Okay, guys. See you.
Take care. Thanks.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
So, Dan, our guy needs a J-O-B.
He's not our guy, but...
Well, my guy, Rob Blagojevich. Well, our former governor. Yes, the circus hasn't ended yet. But we learned yesterday that the clock started ticking the second he got out of prison. He has to get a job, a full-time job, 40-hour-a-week job, within 60 days, or else he'll have to... perform 20 hours of community service a week.
I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do. I obviously need to find a job, need to earn a livelihood. I need to provide for my family.
And since we're into pensions, his state pension has been revoked. The judge used $20,000 of his pension to pay off the fine, so he doesn't owe the $20,000. But federal pension,
so
he still gets
paid
to,
off the fine.
Yeah, we did. Yeah,
yeah.
And then
nice of us.
You're right. Thank you for doing that. And then he gets $15,000 a year in his federal pension from
right,
the time he was
remember.
A congressman.
Yeah. Well,
so what? Did we, how are you going to help a buddy out there? Again, not your buddy.
No, not my buddy. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of standard issue with parole. But with respect to a job for him.
His last job in prison, by the way, was washing dishes, pots and pans for $4 an hour.
It seems like...
He's above that. He should be teaching.
No, actually, it doesn't.
Shakespearean courses.
It doesn't seem like... No, he's not above that. And no, he shouldn't be teaching Shakespeare to anybody because he's a bonehead. He is not an intellectual. He's a dope. And he's a charlatan. And he's a criminal. And he's a convicted felon. That's who he actually is before we get into this stylized soap opera bull jive about Rod and Patty. Has WLS made the announcement yet?
You've got your money on that?
WLS morning team. Rod and Patty. So that's one option. Okay. Another option, he mentioned them in his... banal press conference yesterday in front of his home.
2 days ago.
Whatever. It all runs together. Jesse Senior and Jesse Junior.
Yeah, he mentioned that.
Get the Jesse Smollett deal.
Oh, if get he it. Does do community service,
get it.
He
no,
could
no, no,
hang out
no, for $4 an hour, wash dishes at Rainbow Push. I mean, maybe, you know, since they're in the living wage business, you know, you'd probably make a minimum of $15 an hour. So there's that. Maybe
you can't
along
run
with
Illinois for office.
Maybe along with Jesse Jr., Lori Lightfoot could appoint them to co-head a hate crimes task force. in Chicago. Okay. There's an option.
He can write a book, but he needs a solid job. He has to have an employer paying him a paycheck every 2 weeks.
And he doesn't have to, because then he'll just do community service.
Okay.
And then he can just become a ward of the state, like every other politician in the state. Right? Why not? Just put him in a group home somewhere.
He's only 63.
I didn't say retirement home.
Okay.
I said group home.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a difference. here's the upshot of it all, honestly. I just don't care.
Okay.
I don't care what happens to Rob Blagojevich. I have no empathy for him. Zero. And it confounds me, the people that do. It continues to amaze me, the people in this city and state who spend any mind share arguing about whether he should have got, so you got 6 years or 8 years or 12 or 14. Who cares how long corrupt politicians spend in prison upon their convictions, and so long as they are sentenced within reasonable guidelines, which he was for the crimes for which he was committed? Who cares? And then who cares what happens after, what happens to them when they come back? Maybe he and George Ryan can start a retirement home for convicted Illinois politicians. How about that?
There you go.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We were just talking about how ROD needs a J-O-B.
Oh, thank you, D-A-N.
And that's a perfect segue to this story. There's a new study out, co-authored by UIC professor and former Chicago alderman Dick Simpson, that looks at public corruption stats published by the United States Department of Justice and ranks cities and states by their political corruption. Guess which city is number one in the country in political corruption?
Wait, I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to go with Chicago.
Yeah, that's right, Chicago. We're one number one with a bullet. A lot of bullets, actually. Chicago, during the last 40 years, total of 1,750 public corruption convictions. To compare, L.A., 1,547, New York, 1,360, and, of course, those are communities with significantly more population. So it's nice that we're not just winning on a per capita basis, but also just an aggregate. Yeah. Illinois, by comparison, only number three in the country in terms of most public corruptions per public corruption convictions per capita. D.C. and Louisiana nudged us out, so we can't be happy about that. But the good news is, I think with the two or three concurrent federal investigations ongoing by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago, we may be able to catch them after this year.
Okay.
Or after the next 2 years, you know, you've got to have these cases adjudicated and so forth. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by one of the authors of the study I referenced, Dick Simpson, poli-sci professor at the University of Chicago, University of Illinois at Chicago, and former 44th Ward alderman in the city. Dick, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to do so. Thanks for reading the report in detail. Most people just look at the headline, but I'm glad to see that you looked at the numbers as well. And yeah, unfortunately, we're still number one in corruption.
And I mean, as somebody who is not only a longtime academic, but longtime embedded in the political culture in this city and state, why do you think it is that we just haven't been able to change the paradigm in Chicago for, well, as long as either one of us has been alive and, frankly, as long as Chicago has been incorporated?
It still stems from the fact that we come from a history of machine politics. So in Chicago itself, it's the Chicago Democratic machine, and DuPage, and downstate, it's the Republican machine. And both political parties tended to give out jobs as patronage and favors for voters and crooked contracts to businessmen that supported the particular parties. And that builds a culture where you as a citizen would expect to bribe me as a public official to get something done that you really deserve because you paid your taxes. That history has to change, and there is no one silver bullet. We're making progress in some areas. I would like to think that the commission that's in the state at the moment would take note of all these past convictions and the current investigations and would actually do something, but we're not guaranteed that the commission and then the legislature will.
Well, where have we been making progress in your estimation? Because I think that would be newsworthy to most people listening.
That would be a headline.
Well, one of the big things we got done the last 3 years is we have now mandated that all middle school children and all high school students must take a civic engagement course before they graduate. It's a graduation requirement. That's never been true in Illinois. It's been true in some suburbs, but it's not been true in the city or in most of the state. So we're hoping to train a new generation who will understand the cost of corruption, the reasons for corruption, and the cure for corruption.
How did you obtain all this data? I mean, to find out that we've had 1,750 public corruption convictions since 76 to 2018.
You know, unfortunately, this is our 12th report. I keep hoping to get out of this business, but haven't been able to yet. So we've been looking at the data for more than nearly 20 years. If your listeners are interested in the history, my book, Corrupt Illinois, sort of lays out where the corruption that Dan was referencing in the state going back 150 years has happened. We use the Department of Justice statistics because they're the most reliable. We also look at the state's attorneys who unfortunately don't prosecute corruption very well or hardly at all. And we look at the Inspector General reports. So it takes a couple of months with graduate students to go through the data, look at the news reports, and then compile it. We list most of the major corruption events that happened in 2018 in the report, which is the last year for which the Department of Justice data is available. They only, it takes them a year to, of course, compile the data and then another year to figure out what it means and then publish it to Congress.
I want to pick up on something you just said that's also not a routine part of this conversation. We have state laws against corruption. We have local laws against corruption. And the whole idea of another blue ribbon panel, another commission and panel to look at ways to make Illinois less corrupt and so on and so forth. Why is it that we don't have a history of Cook County state's attorneys and Illinois attorney generals prosecuting corruption, public corruption, that is well within their realm to prosecute? It doesn't always have to be the U.S. Attorney's Office.
No, it doesn't. And usually when, and it's now decades ago, but when Republicans have been elected to the state's attorney's office, they have prosecuted. For instance, Bernie Carey Jack O'Malley did when he was state's attorney. But the political party weight and just the political culture prevents them. Their answer, which is not true or not sufficient, is that they can't prosecute because they don't have wiretap authority. And under certain cases of corruption, it'd be fine with me to give them wiretap authority. I don't want them wiretapping everybody all the time, but if they actively have evidence of corruption, I don't mind them having wiretap, as in the feds tapping Alderman Burke's phone and getting all those connections and convictions that will be coming in Chicago. But I don't find that a sufficient reason. And in fact, part of the debate in the state's attorney's race right now is, should the state's attorney's office be doing more prosecutions in the corruption area?
We've had federal prosecutors in the cities and the state's highest posts, Jim Thompson, governor, Lori Lightfoot now, mayor. Jim Thompson didn't make a dime's worth of difference on the corruption issue, as far as I'm concerned, during his four terms, even though he came out of the U.S. Attorney's Office. What's your early assessment on Lori Lightfoot's tenure as mayor?
Well, Lori Lightfoot has made the most advance on ethics and good government and changes since Harold Washington. I was on their transition to co-chair their transition team committee on ethics and good government called the Good Governance Committee. And she's implemented nearly all of the recommendations of her transition team. The one's gotten the most visible is outlawing aldermanic privilege or prerogative. But there have been actually quite a few individual changes. The ethics code has been rewritten under the recommendations from the Ethics Commission in Chicago. Some of those changes are quite good and closed important loopholes. The biggest single change, and the one I can't understand, well, I understand, but it's outrageous, in Springfield, the biggest change here in Chicago is aldermen can now be investigated by the city inspector general. There is no legislative inspector general, and it can't be quashed because an alderman doesn't want to be investigated. In Springfield, they have a legislative inspector general who first is usually not able to investigate them. And when they do investigate them, they make the report secret.
Hmm. Now, is there anything else, any suggestions you have for Mayor Lori Lightfoot to rule out corruption?
There's still ongoing processes. A lot of it has to do with fairly simple things. For instance, the city clerk supposedly publishes the aldermanic voting record. But in fact, it takes my students 100 hours to assemble a year's voting record in a meaningful form to hold aldermen accountable. There's no reason for that. We've gotten volunteers to design a software program that would make that available every day of the week for every citizen in Chicago that wants to know how their alderman is voting. It's now essentially a state secret how the aldermen vote. Yes, the press might cover a particular vote, but not all the votes and not in context. That's one example that's really under the purview of the city clerk, but we're hoping to hold hearings in the city council's ethics committee sometime during the coming year and to fix that. That's just one simple area. Others, allowing citizens more voice and understanding of government, like the participatory budgeting project in some wards, where they vote on the aldermanic menu money instead of letting the aldermen by themselves decide that $1.3 million expenditure, would be a good way for citizens to begin to understand their government and to understand what their alderman is and isn't doing.
You sort of allude to in this, it's alluded to in this piece on your report by at blockclubchicago.org. That you've got these U.S. attorney investigations into ComEd lobbying, into gaming, into red light cameras. So the scuttlebutt in Springfield is that as many as three dozen Illinois state legislators have received letters from the FBI or from the U.S. attorney's office regarding interest in talking to them, interest in records. There have been subpoenas issued and so on and so forth. Speak to the argument that so many hold on to. That, if we just got rid of Mike Madigan, then, we would usher in a period of good government and milk and honey in Chicago and Illinois. It's just these Chicago Democrat machine bosses from a bygone era that are the problem. And as soon as we get rid of them, then everything will be right with the city and state.
Well, first of all, it's not just the city. The figures we give are for metropolitan Chicago. When we did a study of the suburbs, we found 60 suburbs with 300 public officials from the suburbs who have gone to federal prison for corruption over this last 40 years. Mm-hmm. So assuming that just it's a big, bad, Chicago where it's just Mike Madigan is simply not the case. That said, there ought to be term limits. We have eight recommendations in both the book and the reports as to what we need to do. And term limits is one, a fair mapping of legislative districts so that the voters are choosing the official rather than the official choosing their voters is another example. There are lots of incremental steps that would help but it's not any one person. It is the culture, and changing the culture requires a long-term effort. We're talking about at least a decade to fix the corruption in Chicago and Illinois.
He is Dick Simpson, former Chicago alderman, 44th Ward, longtime political science professor at the University of Illinois Chicago, and the co-author of this report, Chicago is the Most Corrupt City. This report on corruption in Chicago, corruption in cities and states around America, and Chicago is still the corruption capital. I'll tweet that out at Dan Proft. Dick Simpson, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to do so, and hopefully one day we'll see a uncorrupted Illinois.
I can't wait to hear how that works out from Florida. Thank you so much, Dick. Appreciate it.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, just if I could sum Illinois in one sentence.
Yes. Go ahead.
Heard of that report from Dick Simpson. Illinois is the state where kleptocracy meets kakistocracy.
Wow.
All right. Think I could make bumper stickers with that?
A little.
At t-shirts?
I'd start with t-shirts. Bumper stickers may be a little too much.
A lot of ocracies.
Yes.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
It's time for Animal Stories with Uncle Dan and Little Amy.
You remember Joaquin Phoenix when he won Best Actor for Joker a few weeks ago at the Oscars.
Yeah, very profound statements to make.
And when she gives birth, we steal her baby. Even though her cries of anguish are unmistakable. And then we take her milk that's intended for her calf, and we put it in our coffee and our cereal.
It was a William Jennings Bryan moment on the issue of sanctuary for cows and calves. Free the cows.
So is he a vegan or a vegetarian? We know.
In this, intervention he did at the Pico Rivera Slaughterhouse in California, he was wearing some T-shirt that said something about being a vegan. But let me tell you something. He no longer is sporting that thin Joker body.
Yeah.
No.
No.
No, no, no. He's
back up to current weight.
He must be eating a lot of broccoli and asparagus or something, or putting butter on it because butter.
Hey. Watch it.
It's not butter. It's one of those butter substitutes.
Yeah.
Margarine.
Margarine.
Does that matter? Yeah. I don't know. I don't buy
these
things.
No, that matters.
That's his raison d'etre. That is his purpose in life now.
Right.
Joaquin Phoenix to save the cows. So he went to the slaughterhouse 2 days after winning the Best Actor.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's a man of his word, huh?
And, he's a man of his word. Also, this is probably going to be an Oscar-nominated short film next year because the whole thing was shot. He came with a camera crew along with representatives from a group called Farm Sanctuary. Mm-hmm. And met with the slaughterhouse owner and had a conversation about the nature of the business and impressed upon Anthony DeMaria, who's the slaughterhouse CEO, his position. They had a good conversation. Actually, Mr. DeMaria was a lot more indulgent of Joaquin Phoenix than I would have been. For example, this exchange, while they're talking about what happens at the slaughterhouse, this exchange between Phoenix and DeMaria, and tell me if you wouldn't have kicked Phoenix off your property.
So then they were here to be
harvested.
Murdered.
Harvested.
Murdered.
Harvested.
Murdered.
Harvested. You have to understand my side, how I understand yours.
I understand, but your language is powerful.
So, harvested.
Stoned?
Murdered. Okay.
All right.
Harvested or
harvested?
Murdered? The debate rages
harvested?
On.
312-642-5600,
turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Harvested or murdered? Harvested?
Murdered.
Murdered. Yeah, he does sound like he may not be in full possession of his faculties.
Yeah.
I don't know. it ends happily.
Wait,
where DeMaria allows Joaquin Phoenix to take the calf and the calf's mom in a trailer. He gives them to him, or Phoenix bought them for the purposes of completing this film and you needing a happy ending or whatever. And then they drive off the pickup truck pulling the trailer, and they move into some, or they arrive at some land that apparently is owned by Farm Sanctuary. Phoenix names the two Liberty and Indigo.
Is he raising a commune?
I think that was Liberty.
Okay.
And then they're allowed to run free.
As part of our protocol here at Farm Sanctuary, we do a thing where, you know, at first they come in, we make sure that they don't have anything contagious, and they go in with everybody else, then they can run in the hills and do what cats like to do.
Oh, my love.
Right? Oh, isn't she beautiful?
Oh, you should have.
Who's a good girl? All I could think of while watching this 8-minute short that will be Oscar nominated next year.
And I'm watching it right now.
Is, God, I could use some ketchup.
Oh.
Yeah, maybe some relish.
Oh, come on.
I'll do a side salad with indigo rather than the fries. I would like Liberty medium well.
Ew.
Tim in Plainfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, thanks for taking my call. Hi, Amy. Nice to talk with you.
Hi.
Hey, I would think that Joaquin Phoenix would be real kind of happy that the cows are harvested.
Murdered!
Aren't they, like, harvested. One of the number one leaders of greenhouse gas and stuff?
It's actually a great point, Tim, other than your offensive use of the word harvested when murdered. We know they're murdered.
Harvested.
Yeah. Oh, well, I believe no less a climate scientist than AOC talked about the existential threat the planet faces from cow flatulence. So that's a great right. point. How, I would love to see, wouldn't you, a debate between AOC and Joaquin Phoenix on rescuing these bovine creatures, but then also trying to save the planet at the same time, understanding the threat that their flatulence poses. Don't you think? Jim on the north side.
Good morning. There used to be a farm or a ranch in California where people used to go out there to have sex with animals. Would this be the same farm?
Oh,
I don't.
Gross.
Thanks for the call, Jim. I don't know. I think that would be the pornographic remake of the Joaquin Phoenix Farm Sanctuary film.
The calf is cute.
Although Liberty and Indigo do sound like porn star names.
They do.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy and the NIMBY movement, long-standing, could it be in jeopardy as a result of the YIMBY movement? NIMBY meets YIMBY.
NIMBY meets... What are these acronyms you speak of?
You don't know NIMBY?
NIMBY, I know NIMBY.
Not in my backyard, not right? Yeah. YIMBY, yes, in my backyard. An affirmation. This is being driven by millennials who don't have a backyard because they're living in mom and dad's basement. Or they're renting because they can't afford to own a home. And this has actually been argued that one of the reasons you have young people more open-minded to the prospect of socialism than previous generations is because they don't see the economic upside that their parents and grandparents enjoyed in large measure through home ownership.
And well, they have to pay off their student loans. I mean,
but also access to affordable access to homes the way that previous generations had access to them at price points relative to their earning power so that you could accumulate wealth over the course of your working life. That's a big deal. The question is, so why do we have these problems and what to do about it? Has government been the source of the problem, or is it the remedy? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Connor Doherty, economics reporter for the New York Times and author of the new book, Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. Connor, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. So, I think you hit the nail on the head with the wealth accumulation thing.
Yeah. Go ahead and develop that, and particularly as it pertains to the YIMBY movement led by younger people.
Well, the way I always say it is that many of the biggest problems in America today are, at some level, a housing problem. And just to pick the one that you touched on, which is basically economic or income wealth inequality, young people are not acquire. If you think about wealth inequality, it is almost all housing. There are a couple people who are multi-billionaires, but most of the real gap between the haves and have-nots in America is a function of housing wealth. And as you point out, that's okay if you feel reasonably confident that you can get on that escalator yourself. And many kids younger, I mean, when I say kids, I mean people 25 to 35, don't feel that.
And so this seems to be the problems that you're describing and you describe in your book seem to be focused in major urban centers where the problem is perhaps most pronounced. But those are urban centers that largely been governed by one party with a particular philosophy that talk a lot about affordable housing, that all have all kinds of subsidy programs. So it seems like that model is not working.
Yeah, I mean, well, so the it is definitely true that it's not working. I try not to overdo the party stuff because local politics I find not to be terribly ideological in the way we think about it, red, blue.
Well, philosophy, though. I mean, the philosophy is, and this is in the suburbs, too. We know it well in Chicagoland, where you have, here the problem with not being able to afford to live in Winnetka, according to some, and this would be according to a lot of people in the city, too, is, well, you need to make you need to have the government essentially spearhead an affordable housing project. You need to be more open to increasing density in the community. And that's the same thing in the neighborhoods in Chicago, too, when we have programs like super vouchers where people with less means can live in neighborhoods with in buildings with people with more means. But that hasn't worked. That's it works for individual people that are the recipients of those vouchers, I suppose. But it's not working as a categorical policy solution.
Well, yeah, totally. So what I totally agree with you. And, you know, because if we don't have enough affordable housing, we're not going to have, it doesn't matter how many vouchers you have. It doesn't matter how many, million-dollar condos you have. If we don't have enough if we don't have enough housing for the population, we're going to have homelessness and people driving 3.5 hours to work and all the things we see. But I think that what I love about this book, what I loved about the reporting of the book is that there's such an ideological spectrum here. I mean, this book is ultimately about the stories of people who are trying to change politics in housing. And some of them are hardcore libertarians who believe there should be very little regulation of any kind. Mm-hmm. Some of them are hardcore socialists who want to build public housing everywhere. And what I love about this housing issue is that it makes people question how ideological they really are. And that's why I think it really is it's where the rubber meets the road in terms of our kind of political identity. You can go to a suburb, the reddest suburb of Texas, where people talk about they hate the EPA or whatever, right? And they will tell you that their local government should have all sorts of regulations that prevent someone from building high-density housing near them. And I would say to them, well, what about the free market? If you want the free market, whoever owns that land next, you should be able to do whatever they want on that land, right? And then the flip side is you might go to San Francisco where somebody who thinks they're the most liberal person in the world and environmental this and raise taxes that and Bernie that will, you know, they're sort of quietly sitting on a $2.5 million house that they have very low property taxes on because of California property taxes.
Yep.
Yes. And they will tell you that you should never be able to touch that property and nobody should ever be able to build subsidized housing near them. And so I think in a weird way, what housing is so fascinating by is that it isn't red blue. And not only that, it shows how, I mean, I hesitate to use the word hypocritical, but it shows that our ideologies don't often apply to our backyard.
Oh, I know. Look, I agree with that. I think that's well said. And, you know, it's the old tale of the person gets across the bridge and then they want to cut the bridge for the person behind them. We see that rent-seeking behavior in all shapes and forms. So it seems to me that, and I agree with you, that the ideological distribution here. It's very interesting. And it seems to me the start of these conversations that needs to be about premises. Are we going to start from the premise that private property is the cornerstone of a free society and we're going to respect private property rights? Or are we going to start from the premise that, you know, government is the driver of the equitable distribution of this resource called private property?
Well, so we're not going to get rid of the notion of private property in America. So whatever one thinks about that, that's not happening. So, but I do think that we should always be a little bit more honest with ourselves about what private property really means. In America, we have a number of tax schemes and other things that we set up to subsidize homeownership. The 30-year fixed mortgage is basically a creation of the government. The mortgage interest deduction, which has been right. essentially eliminated by Trump, which, you know, that's a kind of a whole other thing we don't have to get into. But, you know, the Trump administration, a lot of liberal kind of crusaders wanted to get rid of the mortgage interest deduction, and then Trump did it. So that's one place they actually kind of agree. But we do subsidize home ownership in all sorts of different ways. And also, you know, look, where do we want to live in America? You look out an airplane window and you see all sorts of land and you have, you know, dreams of, wow, if they invented a teleportation machine, I could live anywhere and have a giant ranch. But that's not really how it works. The way it works is we want to live near whatever we want to live near, a field, a school, a cool retail strip. You know, we have various preferences and we kind of express them with our housing. Mm-hmm. And those preferences are very often a function of some kind of public system, right? Like the streets are public, the schools are frequently public. People frequently move to better public school districts, giant parks, you know, the Chicago Zoo, you know,
the lake, the ocean. Yeah, no, I get it. Okay.
Yeah. And so I guess what I mean is that land, I think that land is this place where it's so fundamental to who we are, pretty much defines our existence, that you can almost, you know, kind of prism whatever ideology you want onto it. You know, if you want to say land is a free market, say it's a free market, but it's a free market that is largely determined by how close you are to public goods, right? I mean, so I think everything gets very topsy-turvy in land, and I really try to explore that from a lot of different angles through the eyes of a lot of different characters in this book. There's a, you know, like you said, this woman who starts this group called BARF, and, you know, the Bay Area Renters Federation, and she's this
great acronym.
Of,
yeah.
She's this kind of crazy, kooky person who shows up to city council meetings in leggings and a tank top and says, you guys need to build more housing. And in, you know, it's in San Francisco, they treat her like she's some libertarian shill. So that's what I loved about it, that the young people moving to San Francisco these days are kind of anti-regulation.
Whatever happened to the rents too damn high guy in New York City? Yeah, this just sort of started this whole movement.
He ran for mayor, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I tell you one thing. His, you know, that slogan has been adopted. What he should have done is copyrighted that slogan. He would be able to afford whatever rent he would want. So, because there was actually a big rent control campaign in California last year, and they kept saying the rent is too damn high, and I hear it everywhere. So I'm only like half kidding that if he would have copyrighted and sold merch, he would have done great.
He is, but, Connor, I'm sorry, we got to let you go, but he is Connor Doherty. He's an economics reporter for the New York Times. The book, Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. Connor, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity. This afternoon at 2 on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I think we may have the cusp of the invention of a new segment. Open Mic Friday.
Open Mic Friday. Yeah, whatever you want to talk about.
Yeah. Now, I've got things I want to talk about. You've
got
things you
want to
talk about. Yeah. But we're getting random calls.
From people? Calls from inside the building? No.
Sean from Elmwood Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I just have to tell you, I was listening to that that guy, who I'm sure is a wonderful guy. And I was told by by Quinn McCarthy, the Informist, that he is a New York best-selling author?
He's an economics reporter for the New York Times, like I said, if you're listening.
Really? Uh-huh. Well, here's what I was listening to. And, Prof, you'll probably get this right. Where is the most improved vacant property?
Most improved.
Improved means a house on it, Amy. Jeez, the blonde. I forgot the blonde was there.
Where would you mean? Like what state?
Where in our society, in all of the society, in every metropolitan area, where is the most improved, empty housing? Around all of those things he said doesn't exist.
I don't understand. I'm not sure I understand the question or the answer. So
there's
all right. Well, here's what he said. His point was, we as human beings desire to be around metropolitan areas.
Right.
We like roads. You remember?
Common roads,
structure,
public transportation.
Okay.
Those are called ghettos.
Parks.
And they have the most vacant, improved properties.
Detroit.
Right now, you want to buy a house? All these kids who live with their mom and dad, you could buy a house, and it could be in a city. It's called a ghetto, but it's a city.
Well, you know what he's saying. I mean, he's talking about living around water. Well, maybe I said that, but he's talking about you move into particular areas because you know you want to send your kids to a particular school, about a green space in the city, and I'm talking about green space in nicer areas, not shooting galleries, as you know. So that. You know what he was saying.
But what he did is what many Democrats and socialists do to rally support. What he did is speak of desire and want as a need, as an entitlement.
Yes, I understand.
The reality is that kind of philosophy is ironically what created these ghettos. And the more society is social engineered and the more you give something for nothing, the more you destroy it.
Well, this is why I said we have to decide what premise we're going to start from. Do we start from a premise of respecting private property rights, or do we start from a premise that government knows best how to engineer the distribution of property among the populace in a particular region? And of course, in all of these big cities that are the locations of most of the problems he's talking about, it's the latter philosophy. But with by the same class of politicians for 100 years, and how's that working out? They obviously say it's not working out well. But the remedy for so many of these advocates is more of the same, make it bigger. So I agree. I mean, think about rent control in New York and the artificial housing shortages that creates. But no, but the YIMBY socialists don't want to discuss that or don't understand it or some combination of the two.
So we could start from the premise of. Government has already successfully usurped property rights and destroyed it. And instead of turning it back over to the people who built the cities, they are deciding to continue to spread the ghetto.
That is true. That's true. But here's one point that he did make. And you know this as a real estate professional, is there's a lot of free market types that are free market, except when it comes to zoning laws to insulate the value of their private property by regulating the private property of somebody else. And that's a problem, too.
Absolutely. And who creates it is exactly who we're turning to fix it. The problem is we don't have enough groups, think tanks, people such as you and your friends with all the letters after your name and the fancy shoes coming up with viable solutions. Instead, we got the Pat Brady's demonizing people who want to fight for their property rights. So that's why, Prof, seek higher ground. Naples, Florida, call Liberty Real Estate Services. Boy, was that a long commercial. Thank you.
Yeah.
shut up.
If Open Mic Friday is going to be like that, then we may have to reconsider this segment. But
I think we should have time limits.
Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Oh, hi, Bob. Good morning.
Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Bob, you're on. It's a big day for you, Bob. Come on,
Buffalo
Bob.
Grove.
You're going to get the Academy Award for engineering.
This segment isn't going well. Mike in Lake Forest.
You guys were too nice to that fella. He sounded nice. Illinois is destroying the value of real estate with real estate taxes.
Yes.
So maybe these millennials are smart, not buying a house. Like what's his name just said, go to Florida, go to Tennessee, where they don't destroy your home with real estate taxes.
Absolutely right, Mike. And this is another matter that is particularly endemic to these deep blue populous states, isn't it? New Jersey, New York, Illinois, Connecticut. Less so California, because the only, you know, good public policy still in effect there is the hard cap from the proposition 30 years ago. But yeah, think about the housing stock and how property taxes have destroyed home equity in those other states I mentioned, all deep blue states. Okay.
All right, let's keep the party going.
Come Illinois on. State Rep Brad Holbrook from Southern Illinois, Shelby County, joins us. Brad?
I love Shelby County on a Friday. Hi, Brad.
What's going on?
Hey, Dan, Amy. How's it? Good. Well, just wanted to touch base with you about the governor's speech on Wednesday.
Sure. Well, it's just potpourri, so go ahead. All right. What about it?
Well, he made a point about how Illinois is united, but yet he really went after the separation movement. You know, that was early on in his speech. It was near the bottom of page 2 out of a 10-page speech. And again, he kind of wanted to talk about how it was so united and how the effort to separate was going nowhere. I just thought it was disingenuous that he didn't really offer up any proposals of reform or any other measures, but the only thing they wanted to talk about was more spending, record spending, $2-plus billion of new spending. All the while, the Paul Simon report shows his approval rating in Chicago, 68%, the suburbs, 53 or 55%, and downstate was like 38%.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, and he also talked about $46 million in revenue we're getting from dope. Oh, my gosh, it's going to solve all our problems. We're going to turn $46 million into $6 billion to pay all our unpaid bills and into $130 billion to pay all our unfunded pension liabilities. It's going to be great. But anyway, I digress. People who don't know, you're leading a band of rebels south of I-80 to secede from Illinois and create your own state. And it's interesting because I just read an article this week about that. Not in Illinois limited to Illinois downstate, but also places like West Virginia. Well, Virginia, a bunch of Virginians want to secede or move into or be considered West Virginia. And it's happening in other like blue states that abut red states or options. So it's very interesting. But what is the status of trying to gather the necessary steam to create another state south of I-80?
Yeah, so basically there's people all over the state. I mean, there's people from Lake County. There's people in northwestern Illinois. So it's not just I-80. But you're right. The effort is growing across the nation. Oregon, Washington, California, Nevada, many other states that have these large population centers are seeing the negative ramifications of Reynolds versus Sims back in 1964, and that's a subject for another day. But the status is new Illinois informational meetings are happening all over the state. We got through Christmas and New Year's. The effort has kind of regained a tremendous amount of new effort. You talked about the Washington Times article that came out Wednesday, Thursday. But there's going to be a great event tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock in Palos Heights at the library there, 1 o'clock. You can go to newillinoisstate.org and find all about it. But the effort is gaining momentum no matter what the governor and his political elites talk about. The effort is gaining some momentum.
All right. Brad, State Representative Brad Holbrook, Republican from Shelby County, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it and updating us on that initiative.
Yeah. Oh, let's go to line one.
All right, well, give him a second chance.
It's
only in the potpourri open mic do you get a second chance segment. So make it good, Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Yeah, my cell phone dropped the call.
No excuses.
Wednesday was the Academy Award presentation. Nobody knows about it. And as Amy said, this is the Academy Award for Engineering.
And who got the big prize, Bob?
Yeah, you ready for this? It's worth $500,000.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Yes. And you all own some of the devices that these two engineers created.
Nice.
Jean Franche and Grant Wilson created this groundbreaking invention that we all take for granted now. It's the miniaturization of the circuitry for our computer devices, like in cell phones, computers, you name the electronic device. They created the technology for reducing the circuitry, so the devices are real small. And nobody knows about this Academy Award, $500,000.
Just for them.
All right. Thanks
Thank
for
you
the
for
call,
bringing
Bob.
It to our attention.
That's the kind of call that we will accept in the open mic.
Yes.
And the only time we'll
succinct,
accept a call like
precise.
That.
And it's about engineering.
And it's about a far off track. I mean, no, it's great. I appreciate Bob from Buffalo Grove and his enthusiasm for engineering as an engineer. I mean, him, not me. John in Mokena.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a proposal. One of your discussions earlier was on the fare map and that proposal.
Yeah.
One of the things I would suggest would be to reconfigure the state Senate to be one senator from each county rather than just supersizing the House legislative districts.
So 102 senators rather than 59, but keep 118 state legislators. And what would,
yeah,
and what would that accomplish?
Well, I think, first of all, it would diversify the power structure from throughout the state. I think it would help bring more diversity from downstate areas.
Oh, well, sure. If you only have one from Cook County, for example, right? And so one from Cook County is equal to one from Randolph County. Okay. All right. Thanks for the call, John. I'm starting to like this segment. We're getting all kinds of wacky ideas.
Can I talk about coronavirus?
No, you have to call in if you want to participate in open mic. Otherwise, you just have to field the calls with me. Vic on the north side.
Yeah, I'll make it short. Just a couple of things about CTA security. You know, it can be efficient and it can be reliable. What it cannot be right now is safe. And there's reasons for that. Years ago, there was a CTA police force that was disbanded by Mayor Byrne. She found that it wasn't reliable as it should be. My uncle used to be second in charge of that.
They couldn't even catch those kids that beat up Rahm Emanuel's kid, remember?
Yes, yeah, you're right. Yeah. The second thing, I don't see why they should allow, I think this would be an idea, I'm a retired policeman, they should allow retired police to ride the CTA. Many people go downtown for different business things. They'd have somebody there riding the train just to keep a monitor on there.
Kind of like
they'd be
marshals.
In plain clothes.
They're marshals.
That's something Rod Blagojevich could do. He tried to give everybody free CTA rides. How about that?
Yeah, the other thing.
It could also be a toll booth operator, as I'm thinking of jobs.
Yeah,
you know, open
whatever
toll
happened to the Guardian Angels? They used to ride the trains with the berets.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if they're riding for free, that'd be a visible added benefit to CTA.
All right.
Because, you know, most of the crime on much of the crime on a CTA is not reported to the police. People ain't got time. It's not worth it. They just have their purse snatched or they get roughed up, and that's it. Why call the police? They're going somewhere. They ain't got time to make a report.
Maybe you should. Thanks for the call, Vic. Maybe people should reconsider taking the CTA at all.
When was the last time you were on the CTA? It's lovely. I'm such a germaphobe right now. I wrap myself in a plastic bubble. And
I think I took a CTA from game two of the 2005 World Series. I took it from Comiskey Park back to the city. I think that may have been the second time I took the L, and it was and will continue to be for the rest of my days the last time. Trixie in Waukesha, Wisconsin, calling as a proxy for Amy.
Hi, Dan.
Yes.
I love your show. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, Trixie.
Me.
Lincoln Park,
it's
Lakeview,
Amy.
Lakeview Trixie. Oh, okay.
Lakeview Trixie, get it? Well, I just want to tell
you, John Barron.
And don't cover your mouth when you cough. Well, that happened in Japan on a train, and guess what happened? Somebody saw somebody cough on a train without wearing a mask, and they hit the emergency button, and everybody got off, and he got arrested. So cover your mouth when you cough. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Trixie. You are going full Trump. And it was weird, because I'm hearing you in studio, so it's in stereo. Holly in St. Louis.
Good. Hey, good morning, you two. Listen, I love Open Line Friday because I have a beef with this term paycheck to paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
If I hear Democrat candidates say again that we've got 6 million people in America living paycheck to paycheck, you know, living paycheck to paycheck is a choice. I mean, Avenatti lived paycheck to paycheck. So why is this a government problem? My husband and I always say that your 20s, you're supposed to live paycheck to paycheck.
Right.
It is not a problem. It is a lifestyle. And these people who are falling for this thing that Bernie Sanders is going to prevent them from having to live paycheck to paycheck, it's a joke.
Well, what they're interested
in, that's a good call,
Holly. Yeah,
call,
but
Holly.
They love that he'll eliminate student loan debt on day one. He loves that your college is going to be free. That's what they're buying into, and it's not.
Andrew in Twinsburg, Ohio.
Yeah, I want to talk about the one of the last questions that was asked at the Democrat debate two nights ago. Mm-hmm. And every candidate on that stage except Bernie says they would be okay with whoever has the most delegates at the time of the Democrat convention, which I think it's in Milwaukee,
right,
not getting the Democrat nomination. And just the hypocrisy of all those candidates when all they do is talk about the integrity of elections and they just want to steal all the votes away from the Bernie voters. It's just the hypocrisy. I can't even comprehend it.
Well, it's funny you mention that. That's another good observation, good call, Andrew. It's funny you mention that because, right, this is the party of electoral college. Whoever gets the most votes wins. I mean, except at our convention. Mm-hmm. Rick in Downers Grove.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Hey, Dan, you're probably the most knowledgeable person on the radio, so maybe
probably.
You can explain this to me.
He is, yes.
Why do people consider soccer a sport? That baffles me.
Oh, come on.
That is a metaphysical question that we just don't have enough time to go into, Rick, but it's a great one. That can't be an open mic. That needs to be sort of a round table with experts and those steeped in philosophy as well as an understanding of human psychoses. So we're going to have to do a special soccer segment. It's, I mean, we know it's not a sport, right? Because if you remove the goals, it wouldn't materially change the game. And
yeah, it would change the game. Nobody would score. But a lot of times no one scores in soccer games. And there's a beloved tie that really gets me excited.
Well, see, this is you working through the philosophy of this in real time as an example of what I'm talking about. But I want to cure people in moss.
Oh, okay.
Rather than just the one-off. So, but it's a great question. We'll hold that for a deeper dive at in another show, Rick. Thanks for that. Chuck in Delvin, Wisconsin.
Hey, I'm glad to be here on this Open Mic Friday. I'm first-time caller, long-time listener.
Uh-huh.
Hey, I just want Holly, Trixie, and a girl from Mount Pleasant's phone number. If your producer can get me with that, I'd be thrilled. Good.
Sure.
Thank you very much. Have a nice weekend.
Yeah, we're happy to be a matchmaking service as well.
It kind of sounded mannish, if you know what I mean.
Hold on to that. We'll make sure we get you those digits. Randy in Lake Geneva.
You know, I was going to say the same thing. Long-time listener, first-time caller, but... Chuck out there first. But anyway, I just want to say that, Amy, you are the most radiant woman in all the empires of the world. If you live to be 100 years old, you will be beautiful every day of your life. You are a goddess. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks for the call, Randy.
Wow. I'm blushing.
I'm sickened.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.